We're going to turn to Nehemiah chapter 2 this morning. Nehemiah chapter 2. And we're going to look at how to tackle a tough job. Ever had a tough job before? Well, I think we've all had some of those jobs where we thought, well, man, this is going to take some doing. Sometimes there's a job that something needs rebuilding. Now, I'm really good at tearing down, but the tough part comes in building it back up or building it and putting it back together. I usually have pieces left over or things left over that should have been in the process there, and I wonder what went wrong. But, our nation has been, for a number of years now, undergoing some unemployment crisis, I guess we could say. And so people have been looking for jobs and trying to find a position here and there. I'm afraid some people don't look hard enough. They kind of like that, not having to work. But I came across some lines from actual resumes. These were some entries that were taken from actual resumes that people put in, their cover letters and so forth, and it was printed in Fortune magazine. And one person said, I received a plaque for Salesperson of the Year. That's really something, you want to tell your new employer. Or how about reason for leaving my last job? Maturity leave. Think about that in a little bit. Maturity leave. Was wholly responsible for two failed financial institutions. That's something your new employer wants to know. It's best for employers that I not work with people. Many other here. I was working for my mom and she decided to move. Or I have an excellent track record, although I'm not a horse. I procrastinate, especially when the task is unpleasant. Instrumental in ruining entire operation for a Midwest chain store. These are actually what people put down on their resumes. Can you believe it? Please don't misconstrue my 14 jobs as job hopping. I've never quit a job. Reason for leaving last job, they insisted all employees get to work by 8:45 a.m. every morning. Could not work under those conditions. I've known a few people like that. And references? None. I've left a path of destruction behind me. Well, Nehemiah, I think, probably had a very impressive resume. And instead of leaving a path of destruction behind him, he was about to tackle the path of destruction in front of him. And his resume would include probably some of the following accomplishments. Cupbearer to the king for many years. A great job stability as long as no one tried to poison the boss. Served in the court and well connected with power brokers of Persia. And probably under the section of his resume which listed some personal information, you'd see things like this. I'm concerned about problems. I have a strong conviction about God's character. I confess my sins on a regular basis. I have confidence in God's promises and I have a commitment to get involved. I believe those are good things that you could say about Nehemiah, and they would be appropriate to be on his job resume. But this is going to kind of be a summary of what we learned last week or the week before when we looked at chapter 1. And in chapter 1, we talked about knowing how to pray. And Nehemiah didn't rely upon his resume when it was time to build. He got out his tools that he could handle, that could be used to handle the tasks before him. And in verses 1 through 10 of chapter 2, we'll see how he had at least five tools in his toolbox. And verses 11 through 20, we'll look at the five tasks that he tackled. And so this morning, we're going to look at how to tackle a tough job. Notice, first of all, tools in Nehemiah's toolbox. And we'll see this in verses 1 through 10. Now, like I said, I don't have a lot of skills regard to building things. In fact, I don't have that many tools. I'd rather buy a book or a golf club than a belt sander any day. But this is a problem for me sometimes. But sometimes I need to fix something. When I was at our last church in Indiana, I had a fellow there that had an entire Ace Hardware in his garage. And whenever we had a need at the church, or I had a need in my home, he would load up his truck with some of the tools that he had. And he had so many tools that I don't know how he even kept track of them. But occasionally, I got to help him do the work. And he was like the surgeon, and I was like his assistant. I would hand him a tool and wipe the sweat off of his brow for him. That's about all good I was for him. But, you know, I appreciate here on our own church, Brother Marski, and how he fixes things around here. And he's got quite a few tools, too. I mean, you need something here, and we don't have that tool here. He'll probably go back to his garage and dig out a tool, and he'll have just what he needs, you know. But Nehemiah had a lot of tools, and he pulled them out one by one, and just when he needed them. And so we're going to look at Nehemiah's toolbox this morning. First, notice the tool of waiting. The tool of waiting. The first tool was a tool of waiting. And we find it in verse 1 of chapter 2. It says, "And it came to pass in the month of Nisan, the 20th year of Artaxerxes the king, that wine was before him. And I took the wine and gave it unto the king. Now I did not, I had not been aforetime sad in his presence." He was a man of decisive action. And when he prayed, it was natural for him to ask God to provide an early, if not immediate, opportunity to speak to the king. Now remember, in our closing verse in chapter 1 indicated that Nehemiah wanted success today in the presence of the king. It says there, "O Lord, I beseech you, let thine ear be attentive to the prayer of thy servant and to the prayer of thy servants who desire to fear thy name and prosper, I pray thee, thy servant this day, and grant him mercy in the sight of this man, for I was the king's cupbearer." You see, he didn't just tell us that he was the king's cupbearer because he wanted us to know what his occupation was. He was telling us that he was the king's cupbearer because this was going to give him an opportunity to say something to the king. He was a very, very closely tied to the king. I mean, he had to test whatever the king would drink to make sure it wasn't poison. So, you know, his job was good as long as no one tried to poison the boss. And so he patiently waited on the Lord for an answer. And just as we're urged to do in Hebrews chapter 6 and verse 12, "That ye be not slothful, but followers of them who through faith and patience inherit the promises." I believe Nehemiah could weep and pray, and he could also wait and pray. Have you ever had to wait on God for an answer to prayer? No doubt you have. You've had something that you've gone to God in prayer, and he doesn't just answer it right away. You've had to wait for it. In Nehemiah's prayer journal, nothing was entered for 4 months because nothing happened. And listen, waiting time isn't always wasted time. Quiet reflection may have provided Nehemiah with fresh insight on how to approach the king. And God wants us to be familiar with this tool of waiting, because we're going to have to use it. There's going to be a day when we're going to have to wait on something. Wait on God and not get ahead of him and wait for his perfect timing. The second tool was the tool of trusting. He fished this tool out of his toolbox, and we find it in verses 2 and 3. Nehemiah was sad in the last part of verse 1, and this verse or this word is used 3 other times to describe how he looked when he was in the presence of the king. And so the king asks him a question to find out why Nehemiah was not his chipper self. Nehemiah was kind of stressed out, and When Artaxerxes asked him this question, he knew the king only wanted to be around happy people. And so in verse 2, he says that he was sore afraid. When the king said unto me, why is thy countenance sad, seeing thou art not sick? There's nothing else but sorrow of heart. Then I was sore afraid. And we could say that there was terrible fear that came upon him. I think he was very much afraid for at least two reasons. He knew that he was expected to be perfectly content just to be in the presence of the king. Subjects who were sad or melancholy around the king were usually executed for raining on his parade, so to speak. And then he was also asked about to ask the monarch of the Persian Empire to reverse a written policy he had made several years earlier about Jerusalem's reconstruction. And this edict was recorded back in Ezra chapter 4. We saw it there in verse 21. He said, give thee now commandment to cause these men to cease and this city not be builded until another commandment shall it be given from me. And so Nehemiah knew it was would take the power of God to get Artaxerxes to change his mind. And I think I'd be afraid too if I was to approach the king and say, hey, how about changing your mind about this? I'd be a little bit fearful, wouldn't you? Well, what are you afraid of this morning? Is there something in your life that's caused you to fear or to be afraid? Some of you might be afraid of the past. You're worried that something you did long ago is going to catch up with you. Maybe you're afraid about the present and you find yourself crippled by the fear of people, snakes, or confined spaces. Others of you might be fearful about the future or even death. In his best-selling book called Who Moved My Cheese, the author asked a very penetrating question, what would you do if you weren't afraid? And he points out that fear often keeps us from taking steps we know we need to take. Fear can paralyze us. There is certainly some fear as we study through this book and see what it takes to build up our lives and our church. But we can't let that keep us from following God's leading. Fortunately, Nehemiah's faith was greater than his fear. He did the right thing because he believed the promises of God. Notice what happened here. He says, I was very much afraid, but I said, instead of paralyzing him, fear propelled him into action. Months of prayer had prepared him for this crucial time in his life. Courage filled him when he realized he was no longer going to be able to hide his grief. And then using wisdom, he affirms his boss by saying, let the king live forever, in verse 3. Let the king live forever. In other words, long live the king. And he explains why he was sad there in verse 3. Why should not my countenance be sad when the city, the place of my father's sepulcher, lieth waste and the gates thereof are consumed with fire? Now, did you notice there that Nehemiah never mentions the name of the city? Jerusalem's history of independence might have turned the king's thought toward questions of politics and national security. Instead of going political here, he chooses the personal route, and that's usually the better choice. And what Nehemiah did say was, I want to honor the burial place of my fathers. And this made a lot of sense to the king because the Persians honored their dead as well. And so Nehemiah's fear would have led him to be timid. But instead he uses the tool of trusting, and he uses it very effectively. And then in verses 4 and 5, he pulls out another very well-used tool. It's the tool of praying. Verse 4 begins with a direct question from the king. For what dost thou make request? In other words, the king was saying, what do you want? And before answering the king of Persia, Nehemiah needed to speak briefly with the king of heaven. I think that's a good thing here that he says here. So I prayed to the God of heaven. He didn't answer the king right away. He prayed to the God of heaven. It could have been a very short prayer because it probably happened between the time the king asked the question and Nehemiah gave his answer. Ever made a quick prayer before? Yeah. We've all been in those situations. Lord, help me in this. You know, I need your help right now. And we've made those quick prayers. And I think this would have been that time when he made one of those quick prayers. I could just picture him standing there sending up an arrow of prayer, so to speak. As we would say, instant messaging, you know. He didn't have time to text it. He just shot it up to the Lord. Instant messaging with God. And he obviously didn't have the time to drop to his knees and bow his head. And if he'd done that, the king would have probably suspected treason. But in his emergency prayer, it had been backed up because he had already been praying and fasting for 4 months. And so he could send a quick prayer to the Lord. And I think that's encouraging to me, because you and I can pray at any time, in any place. We can send up even the briefest prayer to God. And right before you have to give an answer maybe to someone, maybe your boss, or before you respond to your wife or your husband, or when you're disciplining your kids, or when you're looking for a way to impact your neighbors for Christ, just shoot up a prayer. And I don't mean that disrespectfully. I mean that's the way we can operate. God allows us to come to him boldly, in any way, in any form, as we need. And we need to make good use of these chance moments to send up what some people have called popcorn prayers. Well, I don't know if they're called popcorn prayers or not, but I'm convinced that this is the only way that we can fulfill 1 Thessalonians 5:17, where we're challenged to pray continually. Remember now, this isn't the only time we should be praying. We shouldn't be just praying whenever, I'm in trouble, I got to send a quick prayer. We do that because there's been a backlog of prayers that we've been praying. And as I said, there was 4 months of fasting and prayer and intercession that went along with this spontaneous, urgent, instant prayer. It was the tool of praying. And then there's the tool of planning. See this in verses 5 through the first part of verse 8. Nehemiah had lifted his heart to God. Now he must open his mouth to the king. And he practiced both dependent praying and deliberate planning. And I think this is good for us to hear as well. Some people think that all you have to do is pray. And others say, well, you just plan. Well, it shouldn't be either or, it should be both and. We should pray and plan. We're called to pray and plan. We're called to worship and work, to make requests and to fill out requisitions. Notice he knew how to answer the king's question. He had been with the king. He had a close relationship to him there as his cupbearer. And he anticipated the question related to how long his journey would take. So when the king asked, Nehemiah gave him a time frame. He also knew how to plan the dangerous journey by asking for the letters of the king's on the king's stationery, which would give him safe passage to through the different territories that he would have to cross. He says there in verse 5, And I said unto the king, if it please the king, and if thy servant have found favor in thy sight, and would ascend me into Judah unto the city of my father's sepulcher, that I may build it. And then there's the talk about how long the journey would be. And then verse 7, he says, moreover, I said unto the king, if it please the king, let letters be given to the governors beyond the river, that they may convey me over until I come to Judah. He had thought this thing through. He had planned ahead. He knew what he needed, and he didn't stop there. Look at verse 8. It says, in the letter, and a letter to Asaph, the keeper of the king's forest, that he may give me timber, make beams for the gates of the palace, which appertain to the house, and for the wall of the city, and for the house that I shall enter into. And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. We see here he wanted permission to take some timber out of the king's own forest. He wasn't just asking for a gift certificate to Menards. He had done some research to know the keeper of the king's lumber yard was named Asaph. He knew him. This forest was called Paradise in Hebrew, in the Hebrew language, and it looked like a park filled with orchards. And so he asked for and he received three things from the king. He received permission, protection, and provision. He had planned ahead. And he used this tool of planning. And then in verse 8, we have the fifth tool, and that's testifying. He gave testimony to the goodness of God in answering his prayers, guiding his mind, directing his speech, meeting his needs. Look at the last part there, verse 8. And the king granted me according to the good hand of my God upon me. Only God. He recognized that only God could have brought such a dramatic change in the king's mind and the cupbearer's destiny. Nehemiah knew that he was taking what was taking place had everything to do with God's arrangement, not just human contriving. It wasn't just a plan that he came up with, but it's something he had prayed about, and he knew that if it was going to happen, God was going to have to arrange it. It's like what Psalm 118 and verse 23 says, "This is the Lord's doing. It is marvelous in our eyes." That's what he was saying here. Nehemiah was meticulous in his planning, but he would not have been enough if it hadn't been for God's perfect timing, God's constant guidance, God's overruling provision. As we look forward to growing even in our personal lives and the growing of our church body, I'm confident we will see the gracious hand of God upon us. But we must use the tools of waiting, of trusting, of praying, of planting, and we'll see God do something truly amazing. And when he does, we can testify about his gracious provision for us. Verse 10 now introduces some bad guys. In verse 10, it says, when Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the servant, the Ammonite, heard of it, it grieved them exceedingly that there come a man to seek the welfare of the children of Israel. Now, I'm going to come back to them a little bit later, but suffice it to say at this point, they're going to cast a long shadow over the story. And it's usually the way it happens. You know, there's always something that's going to challenge us when we're trying to do a work for God. And here are a couple of men that will challenge that. So we've seen Nehemiah's toolbox. Secondly, notice the task for tackling a tough job. Now, you men, have you ever had a job or a project on the honey-do list that didn't quite go right? I've had a few of those. I suspect if we were to ask your wife, it wouldn't take her long to point out one that you didn't think about. But I know that many of you men have had some genuine mechanical skills, and of course that would never happen to you. But one husband thought he would fix the handle on a microwave, so he just ordered a new one. And when it arrived, he searched the house until he found a screwdriver. Do you have to search the house to find your tools? That means you don't use them very often, right? He was pretty proud of himself, and his wife wasn't going to tell him, but since he asked, she informed him that he had put the handle on upside down. And she put it on the right way, but he hadn't even noticed. Somehow, again, I did not inherit the mechanical skills that my dad had when he was alive. I admire my dad for many things, but I was always amazed how he seemed to know how to tackle a tough job. He could look at a project, he could determine what was needed, what needed to be done first, and sometimes he'd think about it for a while, maybe he even lay awake at night figuring out, but he always knew the steps that needed to be done before the project could be completed. And Nehemiah was a master builder as well. As we move into the second half of this chapter, we'll see how he tackled this tough job, and he tackled five tasks. First of all, he replenished his resources. Notice verse 11. So I came to Jerusalem and was there 3 days. When he arrived in Jerusalem, he could appreciate what his brother Hananiah was so bummed out about. As he looked at the city's shattered walls and the useless gates, he was overwhelmed. But before he could examine them more closely, there was a greater priority, and that Nehemiah needed a nap. And sometimes that's what we need before we tackle job two. We need a good nap, or else we're not going to be able to do it. But this journey had taken 4 months, and it had taken its toll on Nehemiah. He was probably suffering from donkey leg or camel leg. I don't know how, whatever he used, but he was probably suffering because of the long journey. And Ezra had done the same thing when he arrived in Jerusalem many years earlier, when he rested. Remember in Ezra chapter 8 and verse 32, he rested for 3 days. And just as Elijah needed rest under the juniper tree and Jesus withdrew with his disciples for rest, so too you and I need to make sure that we replenish our resources on a regular basis. And there's a Bible principle here. Don't try to make major decisions when you're tired. Ever heard that advice before? I think it's good advice. Don't try to make major decisions when you're tired. And I know that's hard for you to believe, but when I'm short on sleep, I'm usually not very sharp. I'm usually kind of crabby. Sometimes I just need to wait until morning to tackle a job. Now, we shouldn't use that as an excuse. You know, I need to rest 2 weeks before I get after this. But we do need to replenish our resources. We need to get recharged sometimes. And Nehemiah replenished his resources. He came to Jerusalem and was there for 3 days. He took some time to get his rest that he needed. Secondly, he assessed the need. We see this in verses 12 through 16. He knew that in order to lead this project, he would need a firsthand picture of what needed to be done. He then scouted out the damage to the walls one dark night, and when the moonlight was showing the mounds of broken stone and demolished gates, he made some notes to himself. Look at verse 12. It says, "And I arose in the night, and some few men with me, neither told I any man what God had put in my heart to do at Jerusalem. Neither was there any beast with me, save the beast that I rode upon. And I went out by night by the gate of the valley, even before the dragon well, and to the dung port, and viewed the walls of Jerusalem, which were broken down, and the gates thereof were consumed with fire. Then I went to the gate of the fountain, to the king's pool, and there was no place for the beast that was under me to pass. Then I went up in the night by the brook, and viewed the wall, and turned back, and entered by the gate of the valley, and so returned. And the rulers knew not whether I went or what I did, neither had I as yet told it to the Jews, nor to the priests, nor to the nobles, nor to the rulers, nor to the rest that did the work." The moonlight journey is one that is probably one of the most dramatic scenes in the book. I think he discovered at least three things as he did his assessment. Notice, first of all, it was a demanding job. The circuit of the walls was more than a mile long, and the new wall needed to be 3 or 4 feet thick and 15 to 20 feet high. It's not going to be an easy thing, and Nehemiah knew that. His people had to give their best to the job, and the same is true for us. Kingdom work is demanding, and it's worth our energy. Secondly, you notice it was a hazardous assignment. Nehemiah went at night because the enemies were lurking around, and he said nothing to anyone until the time was right. The careless leakage of information might bring the work to an end before it even got started. And then we notice it was a cooperative venture. It was only by surveying the walls and the gates that Nehemiah could calculate how the work would be divided. And that leads us to a third task. After replenishing his resources and assessing the need, Nehemiah now recruited workers. Look at verse 17. "Then said I unto them, Ye see the distress that we are in, how Jerusalem lieth waste, and the gates thereof are burned with fire. Come and let us build up the wall of Jerusalem, that there be no more reproach." In some way, not mentioned here in this narrative, Nehemiah gathers together a large group of prospective partners, and let's look and see how he put this workforce together. Notice, first of all, he identifies with them. He said, "Then said I unto them, Ye see the distress that we are in." He didn't say you or me. He said we. Nehemiah is passionately involved in the city's welfare, and he feels the need make sure that he has people that he's identifying with. Secondly, he presents a spiritual perspective. They're in trouble. And it's not just because Jerusalem is in ruins. He sees the spiritual disgrace. The sight of those collapsed walls for well over a century had created the impression in the pagan mind that God of Israel had abandoned his people. He recognizes there are spiritual issues involved. A building project is more than just brick and mortar. And as people, we have to be aware of the spiritual opportunities and challenges as they present themselves to us. By the way, this is one of the reasons why I appreciate the efforts of our people here to keep our facility in such nice shape. You know, if we let things, the grass grow up and the weeds grow and the thing look in disrepair, what kind of a testimony is that to our community? I've been in churches where that's taken place, and I've been ashamed of it. That there's been, dirty facilities and so forth. What do people think about the God that we serve if we don't keep things decently and in order? There's a spiritual aspect to even the material things that we have here as a church. It speaks of our concern about what God is doing here. And it gives us opportunities to be a testimony for him. And then he invites immediate action. Everybody knows exactly what is required here. He says, come and let us build up the wall of Jerusalem that we be no more a reproach. And everyone realizes the task must begin without further delay. He's asking a lot of the people. He's not afraid to ask them to step up to the plate. The sacrifices would be huge. They would have to take time off from their other work in order to rebuild the walls. And who would protect their families? And before the people could respond, they needed to know that there was someone greater than Nehemiah behind this project. And so he recruited the workers, he identified with them, he presented the spiritual perspective, and he invited them to immediate action. That leads us to the next task, and that is he inspired confidence in the people. Verse 18, then I told them of the hand of God which was good upon me, as also the king's words which had spoken unto me. And they said, let us rise up and build. So they strengthened their hands for this good work. While rebuilding the walls was an important job, the central theme in the book is the sufficiency of God. His mind dwells on the greatness of God, and he wants his workers to do the same. As we think about growth here, even at our own church, seeing our numbers, I think that's important because numbers of people, our numbers represents people, souls that need to be either saved or growing in Christ. But the central thrust must be the sufficiency of God and his sufficiency in our individual lives. Listen again to Nehemiah's testimony. He says, then I told them of the hand of my God, which was good upon me, as also the king's words that he had spoken unto me. He didn't reach Jerusalem because he was a skillful persuader, or because the queen had possibly been a compliant helper, or because the king was a generous benefactor, but only because God was a sovereign provider. He recognized God's hand. And since God had done all that, he could certainly help them to complete the task of rebuilding the walls. By telling the people what God had already done, he was firing them up. He was giving them confidence. And his appeal was positive. He focused on the glory and the greatness of God. And when you think about it, it's amazing that the people said, let us rise up and build. Now, what could they have said? They could have been apathetic. They'd been living in this rubble for a long time. They'd gotten used to it, maybe. But no. Nehemiah comes along and inspires confidence in the people. You know, we often face obstacles, two obstacles within our church as well. Either we're content as the way things are, or we tried that and it didn't work. Right? We get content with the things, way things are, or we say we tried that and it didn't work. Now, I hope that we'll respond like these wall builders did in this chapter. Someone has defined leadership as the art of getting people to do what they ought to do because they want to do it. And I'm thankful to be your pastor. I want to do all I can to help us do the things we ought to do, not only because we should do them, but because we want to do them for God's glory, because the gracious hand of God is upon us. I mean, are you satisfied this morning the way things are? Or is it your desire to see this ministry be vibrant, working ministry that's reaching men and women, boys and girls for Christ? You know, there's excitement about, is there an excitement about coming to Sunday school and the services? Is there anticipation in your life about giving out the gospel through tracts or a word of witness? Are you actively, earnestly, fervently praying for all the services of our ministry? We have services on Sunday morning, Sunday school, Sunday morning, Sunday afternoon or evening. We have a Wednesday night Bible study. Have you ever prayed for those services specifically, that God would do something in our lives, in the lives of those who attend? That leads us to the fifth task, and that is he handled opposition. Whenever we get serious about doing God's work, Satan's going to oppose us. And the first two enemies have already been identified in verse 10. They were Sanballat the Horonite and Tobiah the Ammonite. And they're joined by Geshem the Arab in verse 19. It says there in verse 19, but when Sanballat and the Horonite and Tobiah the servant the Ammonite and Geshem the Arabian heard it, they laughed us to scorn and despised us and said, "What is this thing that ye do? Will ye rebel against the king?" Now, in verse 10, the first two opponents were grieved exceedingly. They were disturbed, and now this trio, troublesome trio, begins to laugh and to mock. Look at their tactics. They derided the efforts of the workers. It says they laughed us to scorn and despised us. That's a part of the enemy's tactics, by the way. They laugh at the workers and belittle them for their resources and their plans. Next, they suggest they're rebelling against the king. That's a weapon that worked at once before in Ezra chapter 4. What is this thing that you do? Will you rebel against the king? That's a cutting allegation to timid workers. And I love the way Nehemiah deals with these bad guys. He doesn't answer their lies or engage in conversation with them, nor does he just ignore them. He first exalts God who called him to the work. Look at verse 20. Then answered I them and said unto them, "The God of heaven, he will prosper us." He wasn't concerned about their fictitious insinuations. He was concerned that God would get the glory for the project. Nehemiah wanted his people to know that God had everything in control. Even though Geshem controlled the southern approach to the city and the other two fellows patrolled the north and the east, Nehemiah was not ruffled in his efforts. His reply made three things very clear. He said, number one, rebuilding the wall is going to be God's work, not ours. And that the Jews were God's servants, and the opponents had no part in this matter. And so then the last part of verse 20, it says it rather strongly. He says, "Therefore we, his servants, will arise and build, and ye have no portion, nor right, nor memorial in Jerusalem." Their opponents had no right, no present prerogative to be there, no future role in that city. And let me just say, as believers, we should expect spiritual opposition when we try to do God's work. It's going to come, and we need to be thankful for it. It's a sign that we've angered the enemy and encroached on some territory he thinks that is his. And so if there's no conflict, no opposition, then we're probably not disturbing the enemy enough. Remember, Satan only shoots at moving targets. And so the tools are out of the toolbox, waiting, trusting, praying, planning, and testifying. And I wonder this morning, are you willing to pick up the tools and start using them? It's not enough just to rely on your religious resume, but the tasks are ready to be tackled. Replenish your resources, assess the need, recruit workers, inspire confidence, and handle the opposition. And this is a continual commitment for a long-term task. God wants us to be fully engaged for the long haul. That reminds me of two fellows in a pickup. They drove to the lumber yard. One of the men walked into the office and said, "We need some 4x2s. The worker says, "You mean 2x4s, don't you?" The man says, "I need to check with my buddy. I'll go check." And he came back. He says, "Yeah, that's what I meant. I mean 2x4s. The worker says, "All right, how long do you need them?" Customer said, "Well, I better go check with my buddy." He came back a few minutes. "We need them a long time. We're going to build a house." You know, if we're going to be a part of a construction project here, and I'm talking about whatever God has for us in the future and the growth of our lives individually or our growth of our church, we need to see God rebuild some things perhaps in our own lives. And we need to rely on Him for the long time. Is it? We saw in our scripture reading this morning, Psalm 127:1 says, "Except the Lord build the house, they labor in vain that build it." Let's pray. Let's bow our heads and pray.